What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
You can sit around with the gin running out of your mouth. You can humiliate me. You can tear me to pieces all night. That's perfectly okay. That's all right.
You can stand it.
I cannot stand it.
You can stand it. You married me for it.
What is it about the night that brings out the worst in people?
I think probably in the case of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, it has more to do with the excessive gin drinking.
That could be it. Maybe more so than the night, Josh. You may have a point there. Nocturnal movies, movies set in the wee hours, is the subject of this week's Film Spotting Top 5, plus Jake Gyllenhaal in Nightcrawler. Our review and more.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
We're also brought to you by Harry's, a company, Josh, that is fixing a problem most of us have, those of us who shave regularly. Paying too much for overpriced razors. Shaving with a dull blade, it really is not fun. You can, of course, cut or scrape yourself with those blades. And as I said, they're just expensive. Sometimes they can run about $4 a blade. So Harry's came along and basically said, not only are we going to make them cheaper and better, give us those high-quality razors at about half the price, but the best part is, and this part I do truly love, Josh, they just ship them right to you. And you set up an automatic plan. I've got my Winston razor, and every 2 months, I get a new set of 8 blades. I never have to run out to the grocery store or the pharmacy and make sure I've got a full stock. The Starter Truman set, it's a great deal. You get the razor handle with a great look and feel, 3 blades, and a choice of either shave cream or foaming gel. It all starts for just $15. And Josh, I'm sure you're aware, I don't see you participating, but this month is Movember.
I'm aware, not participating.
No, a lot of guys not shaving this month in support of research on men's major health issues. Harry's is making a donation to the Movember Fund to show their support. So whether you're growing a beard or want an amazing shave, or like Josh, you just can rock the stubble, Harry's is a company you can feel good about.
Go to harrys.com and get $5 off your first purchase with coupon code FILMSPOTTING, and you can support Movember. That's $5 off your first purchase only when you go to harrys.com and enter coupon code FILMSPOTTING at checkout. We thank Harry's for their support of Film Spotting.
You're listening to Film Spotting, where, based on our billboard, Josh has decided to usurp my role of female voices with that little Elizabeth Taylor.
Do you now understand why I was never allowed to sing lullabies in my house?
I definitely do. We didn't quite plan it this way, Josh, but with daylight savings time ending last weekend, or was it starting? I've never really understood it. I just know that I got an extra hour of sleep.
Yeah, somehow, somewhere. I think it means you can just set your clock to whatever time you want.
Maybe.
That's what I do.
Our top five this week, nocturnal movies, is a perfect fit for everyone out there who heads to work in the dark and leaves for work when it's dark. With maybe a few exceptions, we've put Halloween and our favorite horror movie characters to rest for the top five. There are plenty of movies out there with terrible people doing terrible things in the night without the help of the supernatural. We'll get to that top five later in the show.
First up is our review of Nightcrawler. If it bleeds, it leads. Media culture is the subject, and Jake Gyllenhaal is the bloodhound.
I'm starting a TV news business.
You, get back!
I film breaking stories. Maybe you saw my item this morning with fatal carjacking.
No, I mean, I don't have a TV.
Do you have a cell phone?
Yeah.
Does it have GPS?
Yeah.
Congratulations, you're hired.
Okay. We're taking the next right.
That's stupid!
Repeat the police. I will never ask you to do anything that I wouldn't do myself. Excuse me. I have something you'll be very excited about.
You have a good eye. I want you to contact me when you have something.
Something like this.
Think of our newscast as a screaming woman running down the street with her throat cut.
You will be seeing me again.
Jake Gyllenhaal has always been especially good at playing characters on the edge. His troubled teen in Donnie Darko, his pumped-up Desert Storm soldier in Jarhead, and yes, his alien goofball in the supremely underrated Bubble Boy. Is it too soon for a sacred cow review of Bubble Boy, Adam?
You're serious, aren't you?
I love Bubble Boy.
Of course you do.
To this list, we can add Nightcrawler's Lou Bloom, a freelance news videographer who floats along the late-night streets of Los Angeles, hoping to come across graphic car crashes and fresh murders so that he can sell his footage to local TV stations for the next morning's broadcast. In the review I wrote for my site, I described him as a ghost who's seen a ghost. With his gaunt face and bulging eyes, he swoops onto these crime scenes with an expression of both horror and delight. He grabs the footage he needs and disappears. He's nothing short of ghoulish, and this is before he starts crossing some already blurred journalistic lines. Screenwriter Dan Gilroy, who's also making his directorial debut with Nightcrawler, was interviewed recently by Elvis Mitchell on KCRW's The Treatment, and I was surprised to hear that his take on the character was almost the exact opposite of mine. While Gilroy described Lou as an ambitious guy who's merely taking advantage of the dog-eat-dog social construct in which we now live, I felt as if Nightcrawler was a portrait of a potential serial killer. So committed is it to Lou's predatory point of view, as is Gyllenhaal's mesmerizing performance. Which reading more closely matches yours, Adam? Did Lou Bloom strike you as a sociopath, or is he simply an unscrupulous go-getter taking advantage of a sociopathic system?
Wow. Well, I think I'm with both of you. There's no doubt he's a sociopath. But that said, I'm really with Gilroy on this because it sounds like his take was in perfect sync with where I wanted to start with this movie. And the movie, this film, made me think the most of in a roundabout sort of way. And you're going to hate when I go down this path here in a second, Josh. But this movie has really played better for me over the past 5 days or so since I saw it than it did in the theater. It's one of those films that's really grown on me the more I've thought about it. And the double feature I've been kicking around is Nightcrawler and The Wolf of Wall Street. Because that's another movie with an amoral monster at its core. And I think it's actually fun to consider, first, how different the characters are, right? You have Jordan Belfort, his life is all about excess and personal gratification. And Lou here, Gyllenhaal, he leads a Spartan life. Even his red Dodge Charger that he eventually buys once he makes some money appears really flashy, but more than anything, it's functional. I mean, it gets him to where he wants to go really fast, and it has all the equipment he needs inside. And Jordan, of course, is this traditionally good-looking and charismatic guy who can sweep you up in his rhetoric. And Lou isn't traditionally good-looking or charismatic, but there's something about him that does draw people in. He's not someone you can just easily disregard. The other thing, too, it's probably easy, I think, to watch Nightcrawler and say, well, Lou is worse than Jordan because he directly causes people to suffer. He inflicts pain on other people. And Jordan really doesn't, except, of course, the masses of people whose money he takes advantage of. In the grand scheme of things, who's actually the bigger monster? That's one question we could ask. Another one is, though, what is it about our society and, if you will, our capitalist system that doesn't just allow people like Lou and Jordan to exist, but encourages them to succeed, encourages them to flourish? You said in the tease just a minute ago that the subject of this movie was art, if it bleeds, it leads media culture. And certainly that's part of the film. And Gilroy is commenting on local TV news specifically in certain points. But ultimately, I really see this movie as being one about a man like The Wolf of Wall Street, who recognizes that the true path, maybe the only path to the American dream, to being a self-made man, is to recognize that every single human interaction is a transaction. It's an exchange where you can come out the winner or you can come out the loser. And neither of these characters, Jordan or Lou, do a whole lot of losing because they understand the system and they really understand human nature. And watching both of them, especially Lou here and Nightcrawler, take advantage of people in that way is really sick and twisted and disturbing oftentimes, but also there's something almost exhilarating about it. He's so good at it.
Can I say that there are probably more layers to DiCaprio's Belfort than there are to Gyllenhaal's Lou Bloom?
Maybe.
While also saying that Nightcrawler is still the better film.
Yeah.
A lot of times we'll talk about characters having to have more layers as a good thing, but what I appreciated is the streamlined focus that this movie has on the sociopathic tendencies of Lou Bloom. And as far as the media satire stuff goes, I realize you're separating that from what you think it's really about. That it's almost more of a metaphor.
Exactly.
But there's something almost so literal and even a little bit dated about the media elements it has here that it made it not function as well for me for this larger picture. It's, you know, it's not saying Anchorman 2 earlier this year was very similar in making sort of jabs at contemporary media that you probably could have made 10 years ago or so.
Well, and I'll just say to that point, Josh, the only moment in this whole film where I really felt like Gilroy went astray was a scene, without spoiling anything, near the end of the film where I think it's Rene Russo's character, who's this producer. She's like the news director, but seems to only run the night shift at this station. She becomes affiliated very closely with Gyllenhaal's Lou. And I think she's talking to like the assignment editor, and he comes in with a bit of new news, a bit of development in a case they've been following. And it seems like it's only there to be this network kind of moment, to be this direct bite at local TV news. And it really feels heavy-handed and doesn't need to be there. It doesn't function in the film otherwise.
Yeah, and there are earlier moments like that, too. When they first meet, she kind of gives him the spiel about what she's looking for and says something. Essentially, it's a woman running down the street with
her
throat cut.
And, yeah,
and,
screaming.
Know, so they do, you know, for it to be a metaphor, they spend a lot of time on the literal aspects of it, I guess is what I'm saying. So it did not resonate as deeply for me on that end. But I was okay with that because I do think that this central performance was so fascinating, and Gyllenhaal is so locked in here. And the reason, one of the reasons I went for the side of this guy just being completely psycho and almost a predator who's seen people, we'll get into what you talked about, the transaction aspect of this, but he basically looks at them, what can they do for me at this exact moment? And there's a sign right in the first scene with Gyllenhaal that this guy is off. There is something off about him. He's trying to steal some chain link fencing. At this point, he doesn't have any sort of job, so he's hoping to trade this in a scrapyard, and he gets caught by a security guard. The lights of the security truck cast across his face, and he, for a second or two, rehearses his smile. It might be one of the creepiest things I've seen in a film this year. And it told me right away that this guy is almost like a robot who's trying on human emotions to get the response he needs. He's been programmed for human interaction, but he's not really capable of it.
No.
And the more I watched his behavior, the more it seemed to check with me when you hear people describing the attributes of an actual serial killer, you know, just not able to connect with people on an empathetic human being level. That's what another character says to him. You've got to talk to people like they're human beings at one point. And the point of the film is Lou can't, but he tries. And watching him try is so mesmerizing with this motor mouth way that Gyllenhaal speaks. He just keeps talking and keeps talking as if he's trying to cycle through phrases that will make him sound like a real person.
Yes.
I mean, this is probably, in my mind, Gyllenhaal's best performance, and I like him quite a bit as an actor.
The name of my company is Video Production News, a professional news gathering service. That's how it should be read, and that's how it should be said. I also want to go to the next rung and meet your team and the station manager and the director and the anchors and start developing my own personal relationships. I'd like to start meeting them this morning. You'll take me around, you'll introduce me as the owner and president of Video Production News and remind them of some of my many other stories. I'm not done. I also want to stop our discussion over prices. This will save time. So when I say that a particular number is my lowest price, that's my lowest price. And you can be assured that I arrived at whatever that number is very carefully. Now, when I say that I want these things, I mean that I want them, and I don't want to have to ask again.
He's someone who's grown on me over the years, and I've liked several of his recent performances, and I'm with you. This one has to be at the top, and it's interesting that you talk about him being someone who can't empathize with people. I would say maybe he can't, or maybe, going back to my point about the system, he's just been hardened enough over time. He's recognized how the system works and realized that it's a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. There's no point. He's not going to succeed in a world that forces him or asks him to be empathetic. So he's going to go the other route. And the robot comparison is really good, too, because it was actually bothering me the whole film who he reminded me of, or kind of how I could contextualize this character in this performance. And it finally hit me a day or two later. The best thing I could come up with is he's like Jeff Bridges in Starman, by way of Patrick Bateman. So like your robot character, he's this alien almost from another planet.
No, that's good.
Who seems to only understand how to communicate with other humans based on what he learned in a capsule while he was floating down to space, what he heard on a record or what was said to him.
And for Lou, that's the internet, right? He says that. I've taught myself everything.
He spends most of his day doing that. So it's always, in his case, whatever he's talking about, it is as if he's just regurgitating something he heard or read, whether it's the newspaper or it's online, or it kind of sounds at times like he's been reading self-help book after self-help book. He speaks in platitudes and aphorisms, and that's really disarming. But I mentioned Patrick Bateman because I played a clip a few Top Fives ago where we were talking about meeting that Bateman character from American Psycho, the way he talks about conditioner, right? Mm-hmm. As if he's regurgitating a commercial, an ad campaign, is the way Lou Bloom talks here. At one point, he takes Rene Russo, and I want to talk about this scene if we can, the dinner scene at this Mexican restaurant, and he sells it to her as if he's just reading it straight from an ad he saw somewhere. But that's how he talks all the time. And there is something, like I said, disarming and disturbing and kind of fascinating about it. But I do want to go back to that opening scene as well you mentioned. I think we can get into it a little bit as it is the opening scene. It sets up the entire movie and is really one of the most daring things I think Gilroy does here as a director and as a writer. It's something our producer, former co-host Sam Van Halgren, talked about early in the show. It's something he said that really has been one of the smartest things that I agreed with at the time, and it stuck with me, and I've applied it in a few cases here over the years. This notion that a lot of times a screenplay, any movie, would just be better if you cut out the 20 minutes of exposition it gives you, whether it's at the beginning or somewhere in the middle. Any need, any compulsion to fill in a sort of backstory on a character and give you their psychology so that then you can funnel their actions through that and understand everything they're doing at every point. Sam always said, you know what, just cut it out. Just cut it out and just throw the character into the action and let us as viewers play catch up. And I certainly agree. And this guy, Lou Bloom, from that opening scene in the dark, he just appears. We don't know what his family background is, what his education is, his past jobs, his past traumas, what made him this way. We don't know, and we can sort of piece things together, but we have to constantly be piecing things together, and that's one of the challenges of this movie, is to fill in those blanks and kind of just let his actions determine the character. And that character is all laid out in the opening scene. As you said, he's stealing fence to fence it later, to sell it later. A security guard comes up to him, and he says something to him that's this moment of recognition where he notices that the guy is just that. He's not a real cop. He's just security guard. Yeah. He's not even carrying a weapon. And he's wearing a pretty decent watch. In this transaction, he's about to be the loser, right? At minimum, he's going to get kicked off this property if he's not going to be arrested. He's not going to get the fence he came there to get and that he's stealing. He's not going to be able to sell it later. He's not going to make the money he was expecting to make when he sells it later. Except in that moment, being the man that he is, he realizes that not only can he walk away with what he came for, he can also get that watch if he's simply willing to employ the only leverage he has in that scene. And in this case, it's surprise and the use of physical force. He realizes that he can overpower him. All it takes is the will to do it. And Lou Bloom certainly has the will to do whatever he puts his mind to.
There's a little bit of under the skin flavor to a lot of this movie, and particularly that scene I felt where there's this lasering in on what has to be done, what he wants, what he needs, and how he's going to get it. And that's interesting that you note Sam's comment about backstory, because that came up also in the interview that Dan Gilroy did on the treatment. He talked specifically about having this freedom he felt, having done studio jobs before, with this being more of an independent project, to not do any of that character exposition.
It's
that was
a
one
bold
thing
move.
That was one thing he explicitly sat down to avoid, is not having to fill in those blanks that maybe comment cards would normally ask for if you would screen something for a test audience. So that's definitely an intentional aspect of this film. To go back to that dinner with Russo, I think that is a perfect example of what you brought up in terms of transactions.
For sure.
Because I noticed that as well, that this film is almost structured as, aside from the quote-unquote action scenes of something happening that he records, it's structured as a series of transactions.
It really is.
And this one is where all of, maybe not all of the cards come out on the table, but the most diabolical ones. Because he's proven to her at this point that his footage has more value than anybody else's. The TV station's ratings have begun to rise. And she thinks she's going to this dinner for a negotiation of, okay, he has some valuable content I want. Let's talk about
what
it might
be
worth.
She's going to humor him.
Maybe, yeah. There's also an element of that it could be maybe a date. And she's sent signals that that's not what it is to her. Mm-hmm. But anyways, they're out together. And all of a sudden you realize the amount of research he's done to bring to this table. I mean, this is where the aspect of him being a good businessman comes into it, too. I mean, he's prepared from the business aspect, but then he layers into his package, his proposal, these sexual expectations as well. And Russo, we should talk about her performance overall in the film, but she's so good here because she puts up such a, she's a businesswoman, too. She's shrewd. She survived in this, you know, cutthroat news media, local news business, and she puts up a good fight. But there is eventually a moment where he shows all his cards and she realizes she's defeated. She's trapped. And what's scary about that is when she first meets him, we know more about him than she does at that point. We're screaming at her, just run. Mm-hmm. Get this guy out of your television studio. And at this point, she realizes that's what she should have done, but now she's trapped.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film Nightcrawler, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. We definitely agree on that scene. I think it's probably the best scene in the movie and one of the best scenes of the year, one of the most memorable scenes of the year for me in cinema, that dinner scene with Rene Russo. He wants a relationship with her. As you said, it certainly has a physical notion to it. It might be only physical that he's really after, and he will use whatever power he has, whatever leverage he has to get it. His video, her low ratings, her contract status, her age, her standing in the industry, it doesn't matter. He's got an answer to any challenge she throws back at him. And I think you had to be like me. Most viewers, you're watching that scene, you keep waiting for her to slap him or throw a drink in his face and get up and leave. And I think in most movies, a character would do something like that, except she can't, or that you believe that she believes that she can't.
Right.
He has an answer for everything she tries to rebuff him with, and she needs him. She needs him whether she likes it or not. That's what makes that scene so fascinating. I think another thing about Gyllenhaal's character and the performance, one way he's helped is the way he's shot by Gilroy and by the great cinematographer who shot There Will Be Blood, Robert Elswit, especially during his negotiations and his speeches. And usually they're one and the same. This movie definitely feels like a screenwriter movie, right? Because it's got a lot of really good mm-hmm. dialogue, a lot of juicy lines, a lot of juicy monologues that Gyllenhaal has. But there's one big one in particular early in the film after they've already met. I think it's kind of the second time maybe he's come to the studio with some good tape, and they're standing in front of the studio's backdrop of L.A., the TV news backdrop. And it's the city of dreams. And he lays out for her his dreams, right? How he thinks he's finally found the right fit for him and life. And I kept waiting, Josh, because of that delivery, that Patrick Bateman Starman delivery, the awkwardness of it. Mm-hmm. I kept waiting for the reaction shot. I kept waiting for a release almost of seeing Russo taking this absurdity in and her face speaking for us as viewers, where it's almost like he can't be serious, can he? He doesn't really believe all this with the conviction and passion that he's expressing it. And Gilroy doesn't let us have it. He keeps the camera on him. He forces us to listen to what Lou is saying and how he's saying it. And he does empower him in a way that is disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does. And Gyllenhaal also does that in his whole demeanor, the physicality of this performance as well. I mean, the gauntness is part of this sort of leanness. There's it's very predatorial.
You
where
can tell he lost a lot of weight.
Yeah, you can. And there's nothing. I mean, the obvious thing is it makes his big eyes even bigger, which is quite disturbing. But also it's just that he is this creature of need. He's just going to take what he needs and get it no matter what. So you have that sense of him. He's a little bit greasy here, and you feel like the clothes are a little bit off. They're maybe a little bit outdated or not quite clean enough. It's like he's trying, you know. It all builds into this idea that he's trying to be a presentable human being who can be accepted in society, and he's just a shade off. And everybody seems to know it, but they aren't quite sure what to do about it.
Another element of the film that empowers him in a disturbing way, and you knew this was coming because it came up on your Letterboxd comments about this movie, is the score.
Oh, right.
James Newton Howard here does the music, and it's something that I certainly noticed a lot. I noticed it particularly, though, during the speech I was referring to with Rene Russo. That was maybe the most blatant. It's not like a lot of movie scores in the background for me at all. It's clangy, it's distracting, and here's the real key to it, Josh. It's bizarrely uplifting. It seems to be encouraging Lou's ambition, a little like what you'd hear swelling underneath a coach giving a rousing speech in a sports movie. It's not a dark, moody score with some little hints of uplift, which is more in keeping with this type of movie. It's not really even, though, an uplifting score undercut by hints of darkness. It's kind of just straight up magnificent sometimes, emboldening this character. It compels us to be inspired by him the same way he says he wants to inspire people directly in the film, and some people we see claim to be inspired by him. But we're the only ones who know the truth about him, right? You mentioned that when talking about how we just want to tell Rene Russo to run. We're the only ones as viewers who really know what he's capable of. So there's this little battle going on between us and the music, us and Lou. And all I can say is I hated it in the theater. I really did hate it. And I hated it so much, this disconnect occurring, that it did start to occur to me that the only explanation for it, because Gilroy seems to be so on top of everything else he's doing in this movie, and he does seem to be taking some very blatant risks, some of the ones we've discussed, that it occurred to me it almost does have to be by design. I feel like it had to be. He wants that disconnect. He wants us to be squirming in our seats a little bit. Now, does it mean the score is perfect? Does it mean I wish it could have been a little less distracting? Perhaps. I don't know if it completely conveys maybe what I think he's trying to convey, but at the same time, it's definitely something he's going for. I think it's definitely a risk he's taking in a way to make us identify with a character. Constantly identify with this character that we don't want to, that we want to recoil from, but the music is there, like in a Hollywood film, saying, no, this is a guy you want to like.
So it sounds like you came around on it a little bit.
I'm coming around a little bit.
Okay. Because, yeah, you were pretty harsh about it on Letterboxd, your initial response. And I had said,
I don't like
boy,
the
to
music.
To me, when it came up, I think it was actually another listener who first brought it up, Amanda, I believe. I was like, well, I almost considered it incidental, which I do for a lot of James Newton Howard scores.
Yeah.
And it didn't really stand out to me either way. But thinking about it and some of the other comments that came up on that thread, making arguments similar to yours, maybe I will give James Newton Howard the benefit of the doubt and say it was good that it was incidental to me because it worked in sync with the character and the way it was meant to, for me, a little bit easier, perhaps.
Nightcrawler is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Will Tony Gilroy, the brother of Nightcrawler director Dan Gilroy, win the Film Spotting poll determining the best screenwriter turned director debut? That plus our first two picks for the best nocturnal movies. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us. I saw you rush into the fire, balanced on the bones with the darkness in your eyes. Our thoughts were crippled by desire, suddenly gestalt just colliding in life. I know concentric rings in the bones aside, but surely interruption here. We want to remind you that Film Spotting is brought to you by Harry's. For guys like you who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. and get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code FILMSPOTTING when you check out.
We're also supported once again by Audible.com, a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. They are offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. If somehow you've been listening to Film Spotting for the past 3 or 4 years and haven't tried their service, now's really a good time to jump in. And Josh, thinking about Nightcrawler and Nocturnal movies, I went to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting and did a search for Night. Some of the options that came up, the book Night by Elie Wiesel, which I remember reading as a first-year student in my Images of God in Modern Fiction class.
Heavy.
Heavy indeed, but enlightening as well, as are the other books from Elie Wiesel that I've read. You could get, on a lighter note, not focusing on the Holocaust, Josh, Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live from Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller. There's also Oracle Night, which is a book by really my favorite contemporary author, Paul Auster, in a book narrated by Paul Auster. So three different Night recommendations for you there. And if you've got an Audible recommendation, we do encourage you to share it. We'd love to share your testimonial with our listeners. Just do that by emailing feedback@filmspotting.net, or you could do it over on our Facebook wall or on Twitter.
To download any of these suggestions for free or another one of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
It's not good.
Not good. Oh, okay.
Your actors playing actors. You're in the scene. You're not just filming it. You're in the scene.
Just like that.
I mean, as you're telling him this, you realize that you're attracted to him also. And how are you going to let him know that? And the guilt you feel about telling him about somebody else knowing that. Daddy can't play no, honey.
Daddy doesn't live with us anymore, baby. He had to go find himself.
Okay, had his moment.
Yeah. There's still to feel a little tight.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. That clip there, Philip Seymour Hoffman from Charlie Kaufman, Synecdoche, New York. A couple weeks back, we were looking ahead to our Nightcrawler review, which got us thinking about screenwriter-turned-directing debuts. Nightcrawler was screenwriter Dan Gilroy's directing debut. We're going to get to those poll results here in a moment, but first we did want to mention some more movie passes. We're giving away advanced screening movie passes. You can see, speaking of directing debuts, Josh, The Daily Show's Jon Stewart, his new movie, his first movie, Rosewater, based on the true story of a London journalist who was detained and tortured during his coverage of the 2009 elections in Iran.
Exactly what you'd expect Jon Stewart's debut to be,
right?
Isn't it?
Yeah, and the story behind this a little bit, it actually did come from some involvement with The Daily Show, right? Jason Jones went over to do a story in Iran and pretended to be a spy, and that alerted the government.
I think if you're a regular viewer of The Daily Show, it's not quite that shocking, but still, for someone known as a comedian primarily to make this his choice, it's a little out of line with what
it is, maybe,
expect.
But it does make sense with the fact that The Daily Show has a little bit of an actual connection to this character and some of what he suffered. Gael Garcia Bernal plays the lead character. Rosewater opens November 14th. We've got passes for a Tuesday, November 11th screening here in Chicago. So if you want a chance to see that movie for free with a guest before it comes out, more information is at filmspotting.net. Let's get to that poll question, Josh. Best screenwriter turned directing debut. We gave you five options. And yes, there were lots of people to consider, a lot of famous directors who started as screenwriters, a lot of people who started as screenwriters on television or who wrote for television and then have turned to movies, guys like Joss Whedon and J.J. Abrams. But really, we were looking at directors who really had a firm established reputation as Hollywood screenwriters who then made a movie. We gave you these options. House of Games, David Mamet. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Shane Black, Michael Clayton from Tony Gilroy, Synecdoche, New York, and Charlie Kaufman, or Steven Zaillian's Searching for Bobby Fischer, which I had a feeling was going to finish last, but wanted to include it anyway. Josh, did it finish last?
It is in last, okay, with 6%, but not far away from that. Maybe this is a surprise. Mammoth's House of Games, only 9%.
Wow, maybe more people need to see that film because
I suppose so.
I love it.
Michael Clayton is in the middle here with 19%. Then Kiss Kiss Bang Bang got 24% of the vote. But yeah, clear winner. Synecdoche, New York, 42%.
Jack from Film Spotting East Arlington, Virginia chimes in. Synecdoche will run away with this, as it should. But Michael Clayton only continues to grow in my estimation as a rare and taut thriller with something meaningful to say about information as power. I sort of wish Synecdoche weren't here so Clayton would have a fighting chance. In a nod to an actor and a director at the top of their collective games, the end credits sequence with Clooney in the back of the cab, a silent, lingering shot, sums up everything Clayton feels about what has transpired. His consternation, his exhaustion, his well-nurtured ego are all on display in that one tight face shot. Fascinating to me that it took a screenwriter to figure out that when you've got Clooney, just shoot his damn face. A lot. So much as it kills me, Synecdoche gets my vote. I haven't been able to wash that film off all these years later, and I don't ever want to.
I'm with Jack on this one. Actually, I'll go one more than Jack. I probably would have voted for Michael Clayton on this.
What if you didn't go to the website and vote?
No, I did. I did this time.
There you go.
I remember.
You did this time.
Not quite enough to push Michael Clayton over the top. But I mean, that was a tough choice between those two because I do like Synecdoche. But if you go by the Larson on Film star system, which
yes.
is scientific.
Oh, yeah.
You understand. I believe I have half star more for Michael Clayton. So, Harry,
okay.
I can't cross that.
Yeah, Clayton was a movie that we reviewed on the show that I remember being kind of in the middle on. I was more positive than anything, but I think it might have been an expectations thing more than anything. And no, I didn't love it. It's a movie I need to see again for sure. It was, what was that, 2007? 2007 or 8, so
yeah,
it's been a while.
Yeah, sounds like it. We also heard from Taylor Cole. This game seems rigged. If anyone shows the slightest hint of surprise at Synecdoche, New York winning this thing, they have clearly never listened to the show before. Not that Synecdoche, New York isn't my vote, because it certainly is. Clearly the best of the bunch. Call me a Film Spotting Nation zombie member, I guess.
I think we need a t-shirt with that on it. Film Spotting Nation zombie member.
Though my hunch is that Michael Phillips will somehow offer a write-in vote for Dragon Wick, the 1946 directorial debut of Joseph L. Mankiewicz. You familiar with Dragon Wick?
I am not, but I love that little nod slash dig at our guy Michael Phillips.
He's probably not far off there with that, Taylor.
Choices. Our guy, Max O'Connell from Syracuse, New York, writes over at IndieWire, does great stuff there, and does just as good stuff in our poll questions when he leaves comments. And maybe he just thinks he's built up such a reputation that he can just disregard our options. He says, I'm going to make a case for an older directorial debut by an established screenwriter, one Mr. John Huston with The Maltese Falcon. Huston wrote or co-wrote a number of big movies like the Betty Davis vehicle Jezebel, and two films Huston worked as a screenwriter for, Sergeant York and High Sierra, were released just a few months before Falcon, with the former earning him and his many co-writers an Oscar nomination, and the latter helping launch Humphrey Bogart into stardom, which The Maltese Falcon only cemented. Personally, I think Bogey rarely found a better director for his cynical, tough guy persona than Huston, whose films about jaded loners and harsh worlds were as briskly paced and darkly funny as they were cruel, and The Maltese Falcon set a perfect template for what Huston was so good at.
Wow, that is a well-researched shaming of us for the options we offered.
We'll take always only well-researched shamings here on
yes.
the show. This all brings us to this week's poll question. We are recording this show midweek. Christopher Nolan's Interstellar opened wide earlier today. Josh, you have seen it. I have not.
I have, but I'm going to have to sit on our review because we're not getting to this for a little bit, right?
That's true. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be available here to do the show next week. We're going to have to put Interstellar off. And I will say that there was plenty of hand-wringing behind the scenes about whether or not this was a good idea or you should
right.
just go on with a co-host. And I voted for just go on with a co-host and review Interstellar, but Sam's very persuasive,
mm-hmm.
and he won as usual, and we're going to bring in a guest host. Tasha Robinson is going to be on next week.
Yeah.
You guys are going to do something fun involving the new movie Dear White People, which
That's
is another
plan.
One I really want to see. You haven't caught up with that yet,
no,
right,
I'll
Josh?
Be seeing that in a few days.
So one we both need to see. Interstellar is going to be a couple weeks off, alas. In the meantime, we're going to ask you to dwell on this question. Assuming Nolan hasn't made the definitive 21st century space opera.
He hasn't.
Okay, well, see, that's just not even fair, right? We just admit that 2001 shouldn't even be evoked in discussion of any movie except 2001.
But he tried, so
well,
then it can be invoked.
The question is, who of Nolan's peers is capable of pulling something close to that off? We're giving you six directors, all of whom emerged in the 90s and early 2000s, and who, like Nolan, have brought brains to their big budget filmmaking. This was hard. We definitely considered some options we'll discuss in a moment, but the ones we landed on are.
By the way, sorry about that. I'm getting ahead of myself with the mini review there. It's going to be hard to sit on this for a few weeks. Anyway,
go for it.
The options are Catherine Bigelow, Guillermo del Toro, David Fincher, Paul Greengrass, Peter Jackson, or Ang Lee.
Do you have an initial thought on this? Do you have a vote?
My instinctual vote right now, I'd go with Kathryn Bigelow.
Okay.
I just can't picture what that might be from her, and I can picture what it might be from Del Toro, what it might be from Jackson. Maybe not so much Lee Greengrass. I'm just not interested in his take on something like this.
Okay.
I don't know why. Fincher, same thing.
Mm.
I don't know if he'd be up to something like that.
I don't like him quite as much as you do. I'd like to see Ang Lee's take on it.
Okay.
I think that's my vote, and I do think he's also capable of it. So we want to know what everyone else thinks. And names that were intentionally left off, directors who have already taken the trip to the undiscovered country, guys like Danny Boyle with Sunshine, Soderbergh with Solaris, Aronofsky, who, if not literally, then figuratively already made his 2001 with 2006 as The Fountain, a movie I know you love.
Yeah.
A movie
yeah.
I respect a lot as well. And we were discussing this a little bit. I almost wanted to leave that in there because I don't think of it as maybe a space opera, even though it has hints of that, maybe. There's something about the cosmos going on, I think, in that film.
A little bit of cosmos.
But I think Aronofsky, that movie either is what excludes him from this poll question or makes him the obvious vote.
Well, he swung for the fences on that already in the same way that we're thinking of here
right.
in terms of 2001. I guess that's why I would argue for keeping him off.
Yeah. We also left off Paul Thomas Anderson and Spike Jones. We didn't want to turn this into just a who's your favorite contemporary director poll.
Or speaking of film spotting zombies,
yeah,
PTA would just
PTA.
Win for no
run
reason.
Away.
So.
Well, no, for the reason that he's the greatest living filmmaker. Right, Josh?
I'd go with another Anderson, but.
Oh, you would. You're right. You would. You may be asking, isn't the next 2001 just as likely to come from an unknown or foreign or young emerging director? Probably. That's another poll question that we don't have the strength for at this time. But given time, money, inspiration, and the cojones to see Kubrick and to try and raise him, who among those talented directors could most likely pull it off? Vote now at filmspotting.net. And if you do leave a comment, please let us know where you're listening from.
Give you 10%.
Of what?
My end. What I close. You give me the premium leads, you're in for 10% what I close.
And what if you don't close?
I will close.
Yeah, what if you don't
I will close.
What if you don't? You understand? Then I'm You think you're the only guy with a family? You see what I'm saying to you?
John.
I step out and you don't close, then it's my job. Then I'm
I will close. Now, 10%, John, I can get hot. You know that.
Not lately, you can't.
Now, that's defeatist. It. Go with me. Get on my side and let's do something. You want to run this office? You heard what the man said. Attack. Let's do something.
Poor Shelley the Machine Levine there, Josh, and Glengarry Glen Ross. He just wants those good leads to take out for one night of sits in that David Mamet movie. Maybe he can make some money, get his life back on track. That's not going to happen with Kevin Spacey's Williamson in that great scene. Glengarry Glen Ross, a good choice for a top five list of nocturnal movies, movies that take place primarily at night. Also, as you can tell from that clip, a good choice for a top five list about movies that feature a lot of rain.
Yeah,
it's raining
that's true.
Constantly
yep.
in Glengarry, as it does really seem to take place over one night. And we'll talk about that as we get into our top five nocturnal movies, movies that take place primarily at night, inspired by our review a little bit earlier of Jake Gyllenhaal in Nightcrawler. Glengarry, of course, not eligible for this list. Otherwise, it'd probably be my number one because it's in the pantheon, along with some other notable nocturnal movies like David Lynch's Blue Velvet and Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. I've laid out the criteria, though, here, Josh, already. Nocturnal movies, simply movies that take place predominantly at night. Is there anything more scientific or more ethereal to it?
Well, I think, you know, I wasn't so concerned with the time frame, the literal time frame of it. I tried to think of it as a movie where the dominant nocturnal setting somehow seeps into every corner of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So even if there are daytime scenes or interior scenes, say, if you can feel that sense of night, if it somehow influences the film at all, it was a good candidate for this list. So my number five is Touch of Evil. And what I like about this film is the anything goes quality of the nighttime. You really feel that in this 1958 noir directed by Orson Welles. It also features him as the corrupt police captain of a Mexican-American border town. As in Welles' Mr. Arkadin, where he emphasizes the grotesqueness of his characters, the same thing does happen here. From his own obese American police captain, Hank Quinlan, to Marlene Dietrich, who has this late career bit part as a brothel madam, they're both like performers in the night act of a circus show. These are certainly not the sort of people who would be comfortable in the bright glare of day. And,
mm-hmm.
and so the movie puts them comfortably at night.
You've been cooking at this hour?
Just cleaning up.
Oh. Have you forgotten your old friend?
I told you we were close.
I'm Hank Quinlan.
I didn't recognize you. You should lay off those candy bars.
It's either the candy or the hooch. Must say, I wish it was your chili I was getting fat on. Anyway, you're sure looking good.
You're a mess, honey.
It's telling that I've seen this film many times, and I can't think off the top of my head of a single daytime scene. I'm sure there is one, but even those must be so imbued with the nocturnal quality that the overall darkness of the film, it seems to corrupt them, at least in my memory. And overall, the movie does have this feeling of a night gone wrong. You especially get this sense when Janet Leigh, as the wife of Charlton Heston's Mexican law enforcement official, ends up kidnapped and she gets stashed in an isolated hotel room. And then her kidnappers proceed to throw this drug-fueled party. And things, it's just out of control. Touch of evil overall. It's a night gone wrong in a town where it's night all the time.
Great pick. If I didn't know it was going to make your list, would have been in my top five. As it is, it's going to be just an honorable mention. And a little bit of a disclaimer for this one. I don't like to apologize for lists up front, but this is a list, Josh, that had so many good options. There are so many good movies that really feature nighttime prominently that I could have spent a good 3 hours just dwelling on these picks, instead of about the 30 minutes I was able to give it. So I don't know how good my list
comes
out.
With me over your shoulder, tapping my
watch. Exactly, tonight. We were waiting to get ready here. You were waiting on me, as is usually the case. I did mention to you that I considered trying to make this a little easier on myself by ruling out movies that took place over one night. I thought about, well, maybe we've already done that top five, and if we haven't, that seems like another good future list. So I was going to just focus on films that featured night prominently, but it wasn't just that kind of 24-hour or 12-hour time frame. And then as I looked at it some more, I kind of went down the same path as you, Josh. It wasn't for me just about movies that take place largely at night, but the night representing a time, a place, a spirit where the characters in these movies just behave differently, when the world behaves differently. Normal societal rules just don't seem to exist. It's almost, I think you used the word with Touch of Evil, corrupt. There's almost a corrupting influence of night that seeps through. So that's what I thought about. And rather than rule out those one-night movies completely, I definitely have one here at number five. And it's a case of me and you, Josh, though it's not going to make your list, making good on a little blind spotting, a Martin Scorsese film that neither of us had seen until preparing for this list, and it is After Hours. I didn't love After Hours, but I did like it more than you, Josh.
Really? I thought you would go nuts for it.
You did?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I did like it, and it's a film that, like Nightcrawler, has really stuck with me. It's a movie that doesn't just go away, doesn't just dissipate as soon as it's over. It's probably, though, as I look at my list of Scorsese-ranked films, and I really like all of them, so this isn't a slam on them, but it's my second least favorite. I have it that far near the bottom, but again, that's more a reflection of Scorsese's work. This is a movie that is billed anywhere you look as a dark comedy. And I think just based on what I knew about it, which really was very little, I knew it was a movie with Griffin Dunne and that it takes place over one night. He meets up with Rosanna Arquette. And I thought she was just kind of this zany, wacky character who takes him on an adventure and all hell breaks loose. And he discovers something about himself as he gets in over his head over the course of this night. That's really not what this movie is at all. This movie is funny the way a Kafka story is funny, which is really not at all, but it is absurd. I would say that this isn't a dark comedy. It's just plain dark. It's very sad. And like so many Scorsese movies, maybe fundamentally about loneliness. It's about the depth some people will go to in order to feel some connection to someone or something. And again, that sense of night changing everything. You can occupy yourself during the day with your job. You can be that word processor guy who, even if you don't love it, it's something that fills up your time. At night, that's where that real ache is. That ache of loneliness is really felt and can lead people to extremes. Every single character he meets in this movie over the course of this night is someone who's caught up in some kind of extreme emotion or extreme situation. And by the light of day, not a single one of them would behave the way they do. I believe that anyway. Maybe they'd be a little bit off kilter, but they wouldn't behave the way they do unless it was 2 in the morning, 4 in the morning, whatever it is, as this night just keeps getting more and more insane for the Paul character played by Griffin Dunne. So it is a movie because of that loneliness and because of the fact that it almost, It almost wants to dare you or defy you to laugh at it. That's something I respect about it.
Boy, that is not the response I would have expected that you would have to the film, because the reason I thought you would go for it is pretty much the reason I was a little bit detached from it. I think it's his most obvious comedy that I've seen of his, except maybe The Wolf of Wall Street. And I know that you responded so strongly to that. So I saw those a little bit as a pair. Different subject matters, of course, but in terms of the tone it was going for. And I think when Scorsese, for me, when I sense that he's trying to hit the jokes, it doesn't quite work as well as when they, you know, bubble up from some of the other stuff he's done. So, but I'm going to stick with Scorsese, actually, for my number four. The pick is Bringing Out the Dead, though, from 1999, with Nicolas Cage as a night shift ambulance driver. It follows about three nights in the life of the Cage character as he responds to these horrific calls, really. I mean, they're about bullet-riddled gang members, feeble drunks who show up night after night, pregnant prostitutes. All of this has completely worn out Cage's paramedic, and he just prowls the streets like this zombie of mercy in a way. He's trying to sustain life, but overcome by the stench of death. And one of the conceits in this film is that he's haunted by the ghosts of the patients who have died on his watch.
Claire, Claire, step back!
In the last year, I'd come to believe in such things as spirits leaving the body and not wanting to be put back. Spirits angry at the awkward places death had left them. I understood how crazy it was to think this way, but I was convinced that if I turned around, I'd see old man Burke standing at the window, watching, waiting for us to finish.
I haven't seen Bringing Out the Dead since it came out, but at that time, speaking of the Pantheon pick we couldn't use for this list, Taxi Driver, I really felt like it was its equal. The script here is also by Paul Schrader, which is interesting. And in a way, it's something I know, and I want to revisit it to see what those two look like side by side. But I do think it's something almost of a vindication of what Taxi Driver explored. You could describe it as if Cage's paramedic was the first to show up on the scene after Travis Bickle's climactic carnage. I still need to do that double feature, though, because obviously Pantheon, everyone has it in their Pantheon when it comes to Taxi Driver. So a really esteemed film. But for now, I'll just say Bringing Out the Dead. It'll be my number four on this list.
The one thing we agree on with Bringing Out the Dead is that we both need to see it again, because I haven't seen it since it came out. What was it?
91.
Oh, 99. Yeah. It was that late. Yeah. Wow. Then by 99, I must have seen Taxi Driver, but I don't remember thinking of
Bringing
Out the Dead.
Well, that would be interesting if you saw Bringing Out the Dead first.
It's possible I did.
Really?
It's possible that even though I had seen scenes from Taxi Driver, I don't know if it was one of those films I really watched in its whole until after 1999. It definitely wasn't in my mind, as I recall, when I saw Bringing Out the Dead. And I mentioned my list of movies that I've ranked of Scorsese's films on Letterboxd.
That's
Bringing
after,
Out the Dead is
after
the only
hours?
Movie. Yeah, it's beneath After Hours. Though there are some of his films that maybe aren't the big ones that I still need to see. But Bringing Out the Dead is the only one of those, based on that initial viewing, that I can't really say I like all that much. I remember being very, very mixed on it at the time it came out.
And it didn't get any attention, really. I think it was seen at the time as a Taxi Driver retread rather than something of a piece.
My number four pick for Nocturnal Movie is another film, Josh, as much as I tried to avoid it, another film that takes place over the course of one night. But the reason I particularly love it for this list is how inventive it is with that concept. It's Jim Jarmusch's Night on Earth, because even though it's one night, it takes place in five different cities, five different scenarios. And what it does is actually start in L.A. with night just falling. And we meet some characters, including this cabbie played by Winona Ryder. Jenna Rollins is in the sequence as well. And then it just sort of progresses from there. The New York sequence takes place a little bit later, then Paris. Then we get to Rome, and it's kind of the early morning hours with Roberto Benigni. And then finally Helsinki. This is the end of the night. Now the characters are climbing in a cab to get back home and kind of reflecting on the night they just had. This is another one I haven't seen in ages. Haven't seen it since sometime in the 90s, but it was my introduction to Jarmusch. And I remember just loving all the scenarios and the characters, and again, what it did with that conceit. But also now, as I look at it kind of in retrospect, and we just were talking about Birdman and my dislike for a lot of what Iñárritu does with his films, you think about a movie like Babel, this is kind of the answer to Babel in a lot of ways, where it's this international movie, all these disparate scenarios going on, but of course there's some connection to them ultimately, something underlying these scenarios. And this is what an Iñárritu film would be if he had a sense of humor. You know,
yeah, I was really going to say, Jarmusch has a little bit of a lighter touch.
Just a little bit of a lighter touch. And it really is a fun, fun movie that I need to revisit, along with, obviously, Bringing Out the Dead.
The other Jarmusch film perfect for this list is the one from this year, right? Only Lovers Left Alive.
Yes.
I mean, does that whole thing take place at night?
It really does. Vampire movies, obviously. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit more as we go through the list. Yeah. But vampire movies, obviously, a good candidate for this nocturnal list.
Speaking of that, just for fun, Adam, want to finish our top five list and our best Dracula voices?
Oh, I can't do it
back
the way you just did.
Oh, come on. Otherwise, I could always sing again.
No, let's not do that. Please, no.
Stay with us.
We have a couple donations we want to highlight and mention the featured artist this week, Toronto's Rural Alberta Advantage. There's something just off about that. I'm here to tell you, Josh, I've been to Canada recently and Toronto is not in Alberta.
I'm just trying
it's
to
just
confuse
not.
Us is
I
what
know,
they're doing.
But they have a new album, Mended with Gold. You heard the tunes Terrified and Runners in the Night. See where Sam's going with that, Runners in the Night. The band winds up its North American tour this week with dates down south in Birmingham, Atlanta, and Chapel Hill, then up north to D.C., Philly, and New York City, along with Boston, before heading to the U.K. You can get more info, if you like what you hear, at theraa.com. Let's get to some donations, Josh. We have four new donors we want to highlight this week, including a new $10 a month subscriber.
That would be Ryan S. from San Diego, California.
We're going to stick with California, a new $5 a month donor.
Nathan in Rio Vista.
And if Maddie was here, he would say it's near Chino. And I'm going to assume it is, because I otherwise
right to me.
Have no idea. Other donors we want to thank, Stephen S. in Washington, D.C., and Kelly in Coburg, Victoria, Australia. Now, Kelly, I looked at her donation, Josh. She shares the same name as a Kelly. We got a really interesting, long take on the movie Gone Girl from
Is it
earlier
the same
this
Kelly?
Week. I figure it has to be, but I, of course, could have just looked back at her email to verify where she was from. Did I do that? No.
Okay.
I didn't.
So
instead,
we won't know.
We're going to just riff on it here. But thank you, Kelly. Thank you, Stephen, Nathan, and Ryan. And you know what? We got another great card, handwritten card with a donation sent to our mailbox. This time I got it in pretty good order. I didn't miss anybody's birthday or anniversary this time, but I did forget to bring it to the studio.
Oh.
So,
next
whoever
time.
You were, thank you. We really do appreciate it. A quick correction, and here I'm going to bury corrections in this donation segment, the segment people are most likely to skip here on the show, Josh. But going back to our Whiplash review, there was that musical break. I'm not even going to get into...
This is not going to be a quick correction.
Oh, no, it is, because I'm not even going to try to explain what went wrong.
Good.
If people heard the early version of the show that went up first thing Friday morning was later fixed, there was some confusion about which version of So What we played, and some comments I made about who played the drums on Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. So just skipping all of that, forget all of that for the time being. The one clear correction I do want to make, and this is different than a lot of other corrections, really, throughout the show's history and certainly recently, where you kind of just misspeak or you really do know better, but it just comes out wrong. No, this is a case where I was just completely ignorant. In the movie Whiplash, the main character, Andrew, hears a story a couple times from J.K. Simmons Fletcher that recounts this lore, this jazz lore about a drummer, Joe Jones, throwing a cymbal at Charlie Parker. And that cymbal toss sort of prompting him to be Bird. It's what made him go practice even harder and become the amazing jazz legend he became. So Joe Jones, I only know one Joe Jones in jazz. He's Philly Joe Jones, who did play drums throughout most of the 50s with Miles Davis. And that's what I said when I was talking about our music that we featured on that Whiplash show. And a couple really astute jazz aficionados wrote in and said, actually, no, the Joe Jones the movie's referring to, and if they said it, it just must have gone by so quickly I didn't hear it, is actually Papa Joe Jones. He was before Philly Joe Jones. As far as I know, not related, but I'm probably getting that wrong as well. Papa Joe Jones was the drummer for Count Basie, the Count Basie Orchestra, a little pre-bebop, Josh, which is more my speed. But you can go on YouTube. We'll link to this in the show notes. There's a video that someone on Twitter sent to us of Papa Joe Jones doing a drum solo that's pretty flashy and pretty remarkable. So there you go. All you jazz guys out there, I'm sorry.
See, this is what you get for getting fancy and not just picking the two songs from the movie.
Yeah, or letting Sam pick them. Yeah.
That would have worked too.
Let him be wrong. Love is gonna fix it. How did you expect our love was gonna go tonight? Love is undetected. How did you expect our heart was gonna grow tonight?
Hi, this is John C. Reilly, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
You're listening to Film Spotting, a show being taped at night, talking about night movies. We are sharing our top five nocturnal movies inspired by the new movie Nightcrawler. My number five pick was Martin Scorsese's After Hours. My number four, Jim Jarmusch's Night on Earth. Your picks were?
A couple of heavyweight directors as well, one with Orson Welles and Touch of Evil at five, and Scorsese again, except Bringing Out the Dead was my number four.
The top three awaits us, Josh. Get us started.
Number three is my token horror pick. As you mentioned, we did discuss whether we should just set that aside entirely, maybe set vampire movies aside entirely. Well, I'm going with a film that will cover both of those just so we can make a nod to them. It's Nosferatu. I did consider F.W. Murnau's Sunrise, which is really about the dark parts of the soul that long for the sunrise to come, but I ultimately decided to go with his vampire film of a few years earlier. This is from 1922. Nosferatu, played by Max Schreck, he is the emissary of the night, or at least our deepest fears about the night. The idea that this is not only the time when such creatures might arrive, but they'd actually thrive. I love how Roger Ebert put it in his great movies review. In a sense, Murnau's film is about all of the things we worry about at 3 in the morning: cancer, war, disease, madness. It suggests these dark fears in the very style of its visuals. Much of the film is shot in shadow. The corners of the screen are used more than is ordinary. Characters lurk or cower there, and it's a rule of composition that tension is created when the subject of a shot is removed from the center of the frame. Murnau's special effects add to the disquieting atmosphere. The fast motion of Orlok's servant, the disappearance of the phantom coach, the manifestation of the count out of thin air, the use of a photographic negative to give us white trees against a black sky. That's all true, but Nosferatu probably would have earned a spot on my list for one nocturnal image alone, which is one of the most famous silhouettes in all of movie history. It's that shadow of Nosferatu creeping up the stairs with his elongated fingers and even the nails you can see spreading out across the wall. So if my list needed a logo, I would probably go with that image as it.
That's a great pick. In fact, I could go with the Werner Herzog version of Nosferatu, though some of the most striking images from that movie really are some of the daytime shots, but Klaus Kinski in the Max Schreck role, also incredibly memorable. That's a great pick. My number three, I'm wondering if I'm going to get some pushback on, because I could definitely see people talking about how much of the film takes place during the daytime. But going back to my criteria about there being something different about the environment, something fundamentally distinct about the way characters behave in the nighttime space, that's why the 1972 Bob Fosse film Cabaret stuck out to me. This, of course, is the movie set in 1931 Berlin. You have this American, Sally Bowles, played by Liza Minnelli, who performs at the Kit Kat Club. She meets Brian Roberts, this reserved British man who is played by Michael York. He's an academic, and he kind of wanders into this Kit Kat Club that features the MC, this demonic almost MC, played wonderfully by Joel Grey. And something about that space, when they walk into that club, that only, of course, is open at night, and how all of their fantasies, all of their dreams, all their nightmares can kind of all come true and be realized in that space. And something I talked about a little bit during the review of Cabaret here on the show, when Sam and I did, I think it was our musicals marathon, we talked about this film. Fosse, he's someone who, he really does revel, of course, in the debauchery of it, but he does an interesting thing, though, in terms of the way he kind of mirrors the depiction of violence as the Nazis are kind of coming to power. This is the end of the Weimar Republic in Germany. He mirrors that with the debauchery of what's happening on stage. And rather than sort of separate them as one clearly superior and more noble and pure and innocent compared to the horror of the Nazis, not that he's saying that isn't horrific, but at the same time, they're almost shot in the same kind of grotesque way. There's something about how they go together. There's something about human nature, this dark parts of human nature that can happen in this club and what's happening with Germany. The club is a reflection of that rather than really just trying to distance what's happening on stage from what's happening outside in Berlin. And there is that fantastic moment where the young boy in a daytime scene sings "Tomorrow Will Be Mine." It's this flashback to the past. And that's a great comment by Fosse in that scene. Of course, this is from the Candor and Ebb book and based on the Christopher Isherwood novel. But you watch this film Cabaret and think, okay, well, what does it say about the rise of Nazism? And you've got this powerful scene where in times of trouble, people can escape into the darkness of a club like the Kit Kat Club and get lost in those kind of fantasies, or they can revert back to the past in sort of this patriotic fervor of a time when Germany was more powerful and everybody had better lives. And that same kind of patriotic fervor obviously is going to sweep the country in a really bad way very soon.
The babe in his cradle is closing his eyes. The blossom embraces the bee. But soon, says a whisper, arise, arise, tomorrow belongs to me. Oh, father and father.
I think that works. I mean, especially if you're talking about this unnerving nightclub atmosphere becoming a dominant sensibility that takes over the film.
Yeah,
definitely. My number two is a little bit brighter than that, Before Sunrise. And the title, of course, did bring this to mind right away as an option, but I resisted it because of that brightness. I think of it as a movie that glows. I mean, it's so heartfelt. It's so buoyant that it didn't seem to capture nocturnal very well. But, you know, then I also thought that I wanted to have one movie for this list that had a non-threatening vision of nighttime. And Richard Linklater's 1995 romance certainly is that. The nocturnal element here that I'm going to argue seeps into every corner of this film is intimacy, as Ethan Hawke's American Abroad courts Julie Delpy's French college student over the course of one night in Vienna. Things are quieter and just more intimate at night, and these two certainly take advantage of that. I mentioned Only Lovers Left Alive before. I think that also is a nocturnal film that works in this way. Of course, it also has vampires. Before Sunrise, it taps into this idea that every great night we've had, and this could be, you know, a night out with friends, it could be a date, is fleeting, right? Because morning is on its way, and with it, that magic is going to inevitably dissipate. And here, because Jesse and Celine's few hours together exist under a self-imposed deadline, their words are at once flush with this eager excitement, and they're also solemnly measured with great care. I've described this movie before as at once a flirtatious first date that maybe in a weird sort of time warp is also taking place at a lifelong spouse's deathbed. It holds two of those things in tension. So Before Sunrise, it's a bit of an anomaly pick for this list, but I'm going to go with it.
Well, it's an obvious pick, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way. It should be on this list. Another one that does take place, obviously, over a restricted time period, a limited time period.
Yeah, that's true.
And one I really strongly considered, but ruled out because, for me, it's a borderline pantheon film. It was in contention, certainly a penalty box movie for me, along with another nighttime movie like Blade Runner from Ridley Scott. So I ruled out Before Sunrise, Josh, but I'm glad to see it make your list. My number two pick is a movie I just revisited for the first time since it came out almost 20 years ago, and it's Dark City, a film that I rewatched as part of my Tribute to Ebert class this summer.
Just this summer, right?
Yeah, at the Graham School here at the University of Chicago. And this was a film, of course, that Ebert famously loved, had it as his number one movie of the year, directed by Alex Proyas, who had done The Crow. And you watch this film, and I talked about this in the class. We watched some scenes from these movies. It clearly draws inspiration from sci-fi, from German expressionism, from film noir. You get Metropolis. You get nods to M, to The Asphalt Jungle, and a lot of other noirs and movies that fall into those categories. But what it does, those familiar sights, it comforts you as a viewer while also cueing you to the fact that something about this city, and this is a movie where Rufus Sewell plays a character who wakes up in a bathtub and doesn't really know how he got there and gets a phone call from this Kiefer Sutherland character who has a lot of information for him that his brain really can't process. And then he's kind of trying to put the pieces together of his life. But the familiarity of some of these sites that we see and the tropes that we're familiar with, they also cue us to the fact that something about this city is off, that it is in fact artificial, that it is a construction. And sure enough, we start to see that there are some other forces at work here that are making this city what it is. And what happens in particular at night? Well, the whole movie takes place at night, but at a certain time at night, I think it's when the clock does strike midnight, we see that everything about this city shifts. Characters become new people. They wake up. They all of a sudden have a new life. They don't know that they were someone different before, but somebody is playing with the mechanics, quite literally, of this city and everything about how it's constructed. And Preuss does really have a sly sense of humor here, I think, because he takes this movie, like a lot of noir films that take place primarily at night, and he gives us this film where the sun never shines. At one point, a character says to William Hurt, who plays a detective, "Do you remember the last time, you know, you were out in the sun?" And he has to think about it because his brain feels like, well, of course I've seen the sun, but he hasn't really. None of them really have. So the fact that it's dominated by night, there really are no sunshine scenes at all, except in dreams or in memories and visions. And then the way he uses nighttime to be this place where literally everything changes about these characters' lives is something that really fascinates me. It's a movie that I liked when I saw it originally, but actually really loved it seeing it again in the classroom setting.
Yeah, I like Dark City as well. Maybe not as much as Ebert, though, but I don't know how many people liked it as much as he did. Quite a favorite of his. All right, that brings us to our number ones. Adam, all those times I politely smiled while you mentioned The Night of the Hunter, I hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
And I did, finally, for this list. And obviously, Charles Laughton's 1955 horror film lived up to its many accolades, in part because it is such a creation of the night. Not only in its setting, as so many night scenes are here, of course, but in this nightmarish, surreal, and almost David Lynchian aesthetic sensibility that I felt the movie had. The story follows a false prophet named Harry Powell, played by Robert Mitchum, who pretends to be a minister and preys on unsuspecting widows. His latest target is the mother of two young children because he suspects that her late husband has $10,000 in cash hidden on the property. Mitchum, what a dreamily terrifying presence he is in this movie. And I think that's largely because Laughton and cinematographer Stanley Cortez film him in menacing silhouette most of the time, probably a good quarter of the time his character is in silhouette. That sudden appearance of his shadow on the children's bedroom wall, that's, you know,
and
one of the movies.
Gasps.
Yeah, iconic images. Love that. Even the daytime interior scenes here, though, they have this nocturnal feel to them.
Yeah.
A lot of the rooms where the action takes place, they have sharply angled walls that allow for dramatic shadows. They were reminiscent of another pick of mine, Nosferatu, or actually The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. There's also that nighttime escape by river sequence, which has the children drifting along the black water. I mean, water has never looked so black as in this picture. And of course, there are these nocturnal animals watching, including a croaking toad. The climactic showdown, of course, takes place at night, and it features Powell and the older woman who's taken the children in, played by Lillian Gish. She sits on her porch with a shotgun while he lurks in the shadows. And I love the demented touch that they join in together for a chorus of Leaning on the Everlasting Arms.
What a blessedness, what a peace is mine, leaning on the everlasting arms.
Leaning on Jesus, leaning on Jesus, safe and secure from all.
The waking nightmare that is The Night of the Hunter, that's my number one.
Well, thank you, Josh, for doing all the heavy lifting. I can basically just say ditto. Night of the Hunter is my number one.
That'll work.
As well.
That'll work.
No, I love this film. And if you haven't seen it, obviously, try to watch it. But if you don't have time and are somehow doubting what Josh is selling you and you want to confirm the pick here, just Google it. Google Night of the Hunter, as I did today.
Images.
And click on images. And 99.9% of them will pop up with nighttime shots.
And they won't all be the same one.
And they won't all be the same. And they're all visually brilliant.
Yeah.
They are, like Dark City to some extent, inspired certainly by German Expressionism.
Yes,
there is this real surreal style to a lot of it. Houses, shapes, characters are either in full shadow or part shadow or emerging from shadows at all times. And even, you know, it sets the tone right from the beginning with this opening shot of the nighttime sky, the stars, and Lillian Gish talking and the kids
disembodied
floating
heads. I mean, that's the most Lynchian moment.
I think. It's really chilling, and it really just sets the table for all the chilling things we're going to see unfold. And you could just look at those frames, those Google images from the film. It's not quite as good as watching the film and seeing Robert Mitchum in that just delicious performance as the Reverend Harry Powell. But the images alone, like many masterpieces, they really do stand completely singularly on their own. Night of the Hunter is my number one as well. Those are our top five nocturnal movies. Josh, any honorable mentions that you want to throw in?
I have a couple, because as you said, you could go in so many directions with this list. There's even one I just caught up with new from this year a couple weeks ago, The Box Trolls, the animated film where the trolls come out at night and half of the movie is set and they have these great glowing yellow eyes. A little too soon for that, though. I considered Night of the Living Dead, the seminal zombie picture. Thought about Go, Doug Liman's film about a night of partying gone awry. And a few films I've listed previously on lists. Collateral was on my list of top five Los Angeles movies. How about Nightcrawler for that?
Yeah.
That would be good, too. And La Dolce Vita was on my list of top five movies about fame. So I set those aside. And just a couple more here. Friday Night is a dreamy one-night stand movie from Claire Denis that I gave serious thought to. And The Chaser from our Korean auteurs marathon.
Good pick.
That serial killer genre twister set largely at night.
Next time when you just have one of those in your honorable mentions, send it to me.
Send it your way.
Help me with this top five list, Josh. Even though, as I said, so many good ones, I don't even know where to start with the honorable mentions. I could list at least 20 really good films I considered. I'll just say a few. In addition to Touch of Evil, you talked about Michael Mann and Collateral, a film I definitely am not a fan of, but Heat and Thief, also largely nocturnal movies from Fincher, Zodiac and Seven, vampire movies like Only Lovers Left Alive and Nosferatu and Let the Right One In, the great Swedish vampire movie. Those were all movies I definitely considered, along with some of those takes place over one night movies like Walter Hill's The Warriors. And I'm with you as well on Night of the Living Dead. I thought about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf from Mike Nichols as well, as we referenced that earlier. But I really didn't want to risk you singing again. So I bumped it off the list. Again, those are our top five nocturnal movies. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. Or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at Facebook.com/Filmspotting.
Opening this weekend in limited release here in Chicago, Bird People, according to our buddy David Ehrlich, a simple, wondrous bit of storytelling. It's from France and stars Josh Charles. This is a movie that played recently, maybe at Toronto, one of the big festivals, and I did see some chatter on Twitter. It's been playing on demand. I don't know if it's still there or not, but it's a movie I've been meaning to catch up with. It's out now in limited release. And Camp X-Ray, Kristen Stewart plays a Guantanamo guard who develops a friendship with a detainee.
Typecasting.
That's true. I mean, Guantanamo guard, Kristen Stewart, think about that just all the time. At the Music Box, 1,000 Times Goodnight, Juliette Binoche, the wonderful Juliette Binoche, as a war photojournalist who must choose between work and family. Watchers of the Sky, Josh, not a documentary about the making of the great 1972 Genesis album, Foxtrot, with the opening track, Watchers of the Skies.
I thought we
banned Watchers of the Skies, I should say.
Genesis references.
No, no. It's a new show. It's a new month. I can do it. It is, in fact, not a laughing matter, a documentary about genocide from Nuremberg to Syria. And The Great Invisible, this is a documentary about the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion. A couple others I did want to mention real quick that are of interest to us. Glenn Campbell, the documentary All Be Me. Glenn Campbell is one of those guys who, you know, I always kind of wrote off, and then you really listen to his music. Phenomenal guitar player, just one of the great guitar players with a great singing voice. And this is a documentary about his final tour and his struggle with Alzheimer's. I want to see that. And also Laggies, the new film that's directed but not written by Josh, or largely improvised under the guidance of Lynn Shelton.
So a little bit of a departure for her, then?
It sounds like it. It stars Keira Knightley as a 28-year-old stuck in permanent adolescence. Sam Rockwell is the father to Chloe Grace Moretz, and Caitlin Dever's in it. I want to say Caitlin Dever made my top five up-and-coming
That sounds right.
actresses, so that's out as well. Finally, the big release, Interstellar. It's already opened as of this taping. Our review, as we said earlier, it's coming eventually. Just going to be a few weeks away, so you got plenty of time to see it.
See it twice.
Yeah, see it twice. You'll be plenty prepared for the show. Next week, while I am off, Tasha Robinson from The Dissolve will be here. She's going to join you, Josh, for a review of Dear White People, and you're going to do a top five list. You had some good options here. Movies that are about race, college characters, college movies. You decided on.
We decided on culture clash comedies.
Love it.
That should be fun.
Yeah.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go.
48 Hours. That's my pick.
All right. Can I use that as my number one?
Sure.
Thanks. Thanks also to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. You have a number two for me?
I've been thinking, and I've got nothing.
Trading Places.
Trading Places. Okay. Another good Eddie Murphy movie is going to be the Eddie Murphy Memorial Top 5.
I might just go that way.
Love it.
Our music this week is from Toronto's Rural Alberta Advantage. Comes from their album, Mended with Gold. You can find more information at the RAA.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.